the name of this? The Indigenous Luck Tomorrow? Indigenous Luck Tomorrow. Part two. Are we recording?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Hello, welcome to part two of a series of Indigenous Voices. No, it's not NPR. Even though my voice sounds like that right now. Indigenous Luck Tomorrow. Woo. Well, so for those of you that heard our last recording on Madel's kitchen table, with Madel and Angie's children playing outside, this is part two where we're going to address something that we need to address before we continue. For those of you who will listen, you know, who will listen regularly, and that is, when we say indigeneity, when we say indigenous, what exactly does that mean? And so I guess our conversation this time will be to provide an obviously fluid, but nonetheless somehow productive and important definition of what exactly indigenous means. And so there's a number of different ways that you can approach that. So who would like to start?
Since you're talking, you might as well go.
Maget invokes his, or accepts his male privilege again.
I grant you the privilege of speaking at this moment. Do you second?
Second. Oh, you know what I want to say, too, that I want to shout out to Aaron Malone from Communications.
Oh, yeah.
He's
yeah.
doing the great job of recording our first and this podcast. Thank you, sweetheart.
You're welcome.
Well, obviously, first off, there are formal definitions of what an indigenous person is. You can find them in codified into legal texts, such at the level of the nation state or in terms of the United Nations. You know, these things, the characteristics involved are, what is it? An attachment to land? Jump in.
A history or experience of genocide.
Wait, that's Nisens.
Nisens.
Or no, but, oh, okay. Well, so
he says attachment to land, too. Forced settlement and relocation.
But is that from, like, the UN definition, or?
I have the book with me. It says it's on page 4 and 5. I'm looking at Ronald Nisens' The Origins of Indigenism, Human Rights and the Politics of Identity. It was one of the books that we read last year, and I'm reading it again to help me in a paper I'm writing. Yes, it is United Nations, I think.
Oh, okay. Mm. Yeah, Nisens. For those of you who want to learn more about the category of indigeneity, Nisens' book is a really interesting place to start because it kind of breaks a lot of the miscomprehensions and misunderstandings that people have about what indigenous people are. So one of the big ones is that since indigenous people are attached to land and they tend to be primitive and outside of I'm not saying that they're primitive, but that's the conception that they are, outside of the nation and so on, you tend to conceive of them as being rooted local, so not really having any consciousness of the global, what goes on beyond just, you know, their village, their city, whatever, their community. But by tracing the developments of indigeneity and how it has been deployed by different groups, in particular since World War II, Nisens goes on to say that in reality, the category of indigeneity is actually incredibly global and incredibly inclusive, not parochial, as a lot of people tend to see it as, like, people who fear outsiders and so on. And so that's a really interesting way to start thinking about indigeneity, is that it's very inclusive. So this notion of an indigenous culture, an indigenous person, like, throughout the world, people gather, or people, like, you know, people come into this category, and rarely ever kind of are they rejected. It's a very inclusive and it's a very welcoming category. So, like, you know, I've heard stories about indigenous conferences and meetings where activists gather together and stuff, and very rarely is there an issue of, like, no, those people aren't indigenous. Like, they come from, like, even this, and then we tend to think of indigenous people as, okay, but I'm talking too much. Someone else talk.
Well, what you were saying makes me think, hey, it's Angie Morrill from the first one. We should probably introduce ourselves each time for the first couple podcasts, but it reminds me of, Andrea Smith gave the keynote speech at USC last spring at the, I can't remember what the name of the conference was, something about gaps and breaks.
The National and the Natural, yeah.
Yeah, it's an ethnic studies conference, and for the graduate students of USC, UC Berkeley, and UCSD. And she was talking about the inclusiveness of, she was talking about Native American women and feminism, but what she said was that, you know, centering indigeneity, it's not like, there's not going to be retribution, that it's more, it's about social justice. And actually, Nizan has this interesting thing too, like the I'm not being very articulate, but the point was that that the category of indigeneity and the characteristics of indigeneity are a tool towards social justice. And one thing that Nizan does also write is that there's this primordial element, this time immemorial, you know, in the way past prehistory. And then there's also this innovation that goes along with indigeneity, which is an interesting thing. And he writes on that the concept of indigeneity is been widely accepted in recent years, and that it has been is interesting too. And I think that that's because of the human rights and the and because of the inclusiveness of the identity, because people, you know, the you can't be a part of this, and this is just for us. But that it hasn't been effective, right? So inclusion is a more effective tool for social justice.
I agree. Well, you know what I was just thinking while you were talking, Angie. This is Madel Sar Narangis Madel. Anyway, I was thinking that.
Right, but what I said didn't really go with what Miguette said.
So. I was about to talk for an hour. So
good thing I stopped. Someday we'll do just that. We'll be like the one where Miguette talks for an hour. Madel and I are going to go get some coffee, and it'll just be you talking for an hour.
And so the what I was saying was that while Angie was talking, I was thinking about. My understanding and interpretation of the ways in which my people, and when I say my people, I'm speaking of Belawans, how Belawans have sort of held inclusive behavioral characteristics when I was younger, not so much anymore. Now it's becoming more apparent that it's an issue about whether or not you are Palawan enough or you belong in a certain clan or social status. And that had never been an issue before. And I think that it's interesting how you're talking about prehistory and all that other stuff and then we're talking about inclusiveness and how that was more productive for our societies. I'm assuming that it was more productive in terms of maintaining stability within the communities, the villages, what have you, and also strengthening relations. Because if it was always about, well, you don't look Palawan enough, and, well, you just got here a few months ago, so you can't have a say in what we're going to eat tomorrow. I mean, I think that it seems really pragmatic, that idea of inclusivity, but what do I know? I think that's part of what we're trying to do in these conversations, is to identify or try to grasp the...
Grasp? You were saying something about grasp.
Grasping what?
I don't know, you were...
Okay, well, I don't remember what I was saying. Oh, we were trying to grasp what indigeneity means and what indigenous epistemology would look like, if we can even pinpoint or pin down what that is, or if it's any one thing. Maybe it's a combination of a whole lot of things. So that's part of why we're having this conversation, I think, or I hope so.
Well, there's... I mean, yeah, there's so many different ways to approach it. Like, is it... I mean, you know, do you kind of define it kind of negatively, like the way the United Nations does? It's like, these are people that have been oppressed, that have been denied self-determination, have been the victims of genocide, and they're attached to the land, you know? And that's basically the only positive attribute that they said. The rest is that these are people who form a community based on...
That's my son, Leroy. He's demanding some attention. Yeah, go ahead and pause. Okay, you can start. Well, okay, so we're talking about indigeneity, and we were talking about the characteristics and the category and what it is. And I was thinking about this book that we had read in our class, Partha Chatterjee's...
The Nation and Its Fragments.
Right. And that there's some element of indigeneity that is...
I'm trying to remember his exact argument.
Yeah, maybe that's not important.
No, well, no, it is in a way... let me think here. But I mean, I guess it's...
Well, maybe we should stick to our own...
Yeah, because the subaltern, you know, the subaltern studies guys, they're kind of interesting. You could... They make claims that are useful for indigenous people because although they don't necessarily address indigenous groups in India, they address groups that have kind of a similar subordinated position in the nation and what attributes they have or can have but are often denied in the course of history. So, you know, so agency and so on. So, like, you know, are the gears of history kind of outside the realm of these people? Can they change the course of history? Can they do anything? Or, you know, are they just kind of subordinated by larger groups or by more privileged groups and so on? But
see, I think that's very interesting. So I'm reading a line from the book that says, "The project then is to claim for us the once colonized, our freedom of imagination," which is, to me, what you're talking about, agency and all that. But so if everybody had that, does that then make them indigenous?
No, yeah, that's why he's not necessarily talking about indigenous. Okay. But he's right in one way, though. That is kind of what indigenous epistemology is, because it is kind of, you know, critical interventions, right?
Right.
So it is kind of reversing the colonial gaze, finding room to maneuver by kind of taking what has been forced upon you, you know, and creating space in that where you can find sovereignty, where you can articulate resistance and so on. So that's why, I mean, for me, indigenous epistemology is largely critical. Like, it's kind of about the methodologies and the different interventions that I make into kind of the world of modernity, which just kind of subsumes everything underneath it. So one thing that I really, really detest is the fact that although you can make a claim to something being indigenous or claim to come from this place, like, there's always something that someone can do to say that whatever you're saying is modern. And that's always the big frustration, is that you know, is that modernity is something which has the ability to constantly change the coordinates of its existence and therefore can take everything into it. Mm. Like, and that's what really pisses me off, because that's where that's part of the whole anti-essentialist, like, project, is that you deny all of those things. I mean, so anti-essentialism may be good in some ways, but at the same time, it prevents there from being anything outside of modernity. So it takes away the systems of knowledge, the worldviews that indigenous people have.
But that's weird because I'm thinking of indigeneity as being the way you're describing modernity, as taking it on all in. That's how I feel indigeneity or indigenous epistemology functions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But modernity has sort of taken over that space. No,
that's why it's interesting when people who are, because I guess colonialism in the dominant text is understood to start like at certain points, like especially with the colonization of Africa and India and so on. But then people who, like Walter Bignolo, who take it further back to the colonization of the Americas, like they do so and then they recognize that there is not just one modernity, but there are different types of modernities. So modernity kind of as just an epistemology and a way of thinking. And so what happens with the colonization of the Americas is that certain modernities are kind of destroyed or subsumed. The knowledge systems that the Mayans or the Incas or the Aztecs or whatever have, they kind of get destroyed, and this modernity becomes global, taking over everything. So you could articulate a modernity, you know, just as a system of knowledge which any people can have.
But so, see, that's my problem, though. I had wrote a note to myself before, right? That what if modernity, or what if indigeneity is in fact the thing that's being transported, not modernity, but we've decided or somebody chose to call it modernity. What if it's indigeneity? Right, because you just say that the Incas no longer exist or whatever. But what if the Incas ended up sort of, how did you describe modernity? It sucked sucks everything in. Well, what if indigeneity was like that? It sucked everything in, and here we are thinking that it's modernity, but what if it's actually indigeneity?
Well, I think one way that we could critique that is thinking about Western epistemologies,
yes.
Right? Because we know that, got a look on your face. I was like, what? Am I way off?
Sorry, no.
Well, I kind of, you know,
no,
I mean,
No, go ahead.
But
I was gargling.
Because I guess part of it is because we know a little bit what we're up against. You know, I mean, we know what we're outside of in some ways. I was reading this article just because it had an interesting idea in it from, what is this from? It's a review of this book, Messy Beginnings, Post-Coloniality and Early American Studies. And what it's saying, oh, it's from American Quarterly. What it concludes to say is that if there is this, it says, if even the most assaulted colonized subjectivities somehow retain the logic of former identities, is the same true for colonizers? I don't think things are so separate. You know, I mean, I agree with you that one time when I was a kid and I was sad, you know, I mean, we learned these things in American history that'll break your heart. And I mean, I was maybe in fifth grade and I said to my mom, you know, that I was depressed about these things, and especially around Thanksgiving time of year. Oh my goodness. And she said, you know, Angie, if those people hadn't, the Europeans hadn't gotten on boats and come here, and she says, we would have gotten on boats and went
to Palau.
To Palau. Set up some drums, you know, brought a couple bison.
Right.
I don't know. But when she said that to me, it broke something, you know, because my mom's real smart, and that things don't have to be, you know, one, yeah, it does. You don't have to accept the top down. You don't have to accept like that, because things happened in a certain way, we think that is the way, you know. I mean, there's still room, I think, to argue, you know. Of course there is, because that's kind of what we do here, right?
That's a good point, because when you, like that thing that your mom said, because that's the thing that, like, the reason that I guess indigenous epistemology is so kind of marginalized today, especially in academia, is because it doesn't because it doesn't have that thing that all indigenous communities kind of strive for, and that's like sovereignty. Because it gets deprived of that existence, which is its own existence, right? Instead, it's just this kind of thing to include, this dependent thing, this kind of not really their thing. Like, when people write those things, it's only because of modern knowledge. They're using Western methodologies to write their text. It's just like, you know, you're using Western items to live your lives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there becomes, you know, there's this hegemony around that. And so that's why even, you know, the people who are the presently colonized or the formerly colonized accept that, right? So they accept that the way that anthropological knowledge says that your existence is supposed to be structured is that's the way it is, right? So in the case of Guam, like, a lot of Chamorros say that there's no real Chamorros anymore, that there aren't any Chamorros, that Chamorros don't exist. Even though there's at least 200,000 of us on this planet right now, but just because there's this hegemony around, you know, around modern knowledge, right? So the anthropologist wins. The anthropologist says that the indigenous is dead, or because they have accepted, like, the gift of modernity, the gift of death, they will die eventually. They can only die.
Mm. Yeah, it's hard to swallow. But there's 200,000 of you?
Yeah.
Not just like me.
Thank goodness.
But for me, that's why it's so important that indigenous epistemology be critical and constantly confront modern knowledge and constantly work to produce sovereignty through that critique.
But can I say something? It doesn't have to be perfect, though.
No,
because I don't think that that's or right or good all the time, right? Like, I
hardly ever.
Right. I mean, I feel like when we say indigenous epistemology, people automatically assume we're trying to propose or introduce something that's going to counter or be better than, say, Western epistemology. I don't think so. And I think the work that our department does around this idea of, they say co-constitutive. You know, oh, that's constituted of that. That is an indigenous epistemological way of thinking.
You know what, Medalia, you're so right, because what you're saying is that it's present, and I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And it's teasing it out, mm-hmm. as, you know, making it visible. And because I was thinking that when Natalia Molina was saying that, I'm like, you know what, you do know what they are, because she's so smart, she's got so much going on, but you don't know that you do, because
we're so eager to name things. But what if, I don't think that indigenous epistemology always can be visible or nameable or articulatable. I'm making up words here, okay? That's indigenous epistemology.
I agree completely. I do. And I think that fear comes with giving, like, the moral high ground, because you tie genocide and all these mm-hmm. and things together, and it's like nobody can argue with you then, because, you know, you're unimpeachable. And but I think the fear of, like, taking on my fake project that I'm, you know, my master's thesis, and I've been telling my cohort this, and I'm sure they don't, that we can make mistakes, and we don't have to do this perfect,
mm-hmm.
and that we might not be able to produce the work that we dream of producing, because we are second-year grad students, and but that's not really an acceptable way to sort of go about the work. Because it removes some of the dread and the fear and the anxiety, but there's still plenty of it to go around. So, Miket, do you want to give out your email? Because I know that Medell has things to do tonight. So,
oh yeah. So, thank you for listening. You can contact us at through my email at mlbasquiat@hotmail.com. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you.
Comments, questions, thoughts.
Corrections.
Probably lots of those. Yes, thank you so much for listening. We're going to do it again, so we'll look forward to number 3 and maybe the next time bringing in some of your feedback.
Bye.
Bye.